Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and every major podcast provider. So if you can't catch the show live, you can download it or simply use our free podcast player on our website, which is www.theorganicview.com. Also, if you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can submit your questions. You can post the questions on our wall on Facebook, send us a tweet to Twitter, or simply give us a call on our caller hotline at area code 917-932-1068. Today's topic, horticulture for the holidays, the interesting origins, care, and plant selection. Now, the holidays are constantly evolving when it comes to how we incorporate nature into our celebrations. Long ago, holiday celebrations included such bizarre things as the use of parasitic plants and the seasonal celebration for Saturn and lighting the darkness around the solstice, to name a few of the traditions which color our holiday landscapes. Now, if you walk into any local grocery store, discount merchandise retailer, hardware, or nursery, you'll be greeted by this red, vibrant color of the poinsettia. And did you know that the poinsettia is also called the Secretary of War? Just where did it come from, and how did it evolve into a core component for our holiday dinner table arrangement? With the popularity of mixing cultures, we are now finding blue and white Hanukkah plants, ostentatious naked ladies, a.k.a. Amaryllis belladonna, with confusing names are just some of the seasonal flowers that we associate with this festive time of the year. Today on The Organic View, I have the pleasure of welcoming back Mr. John Peter Thompson, who is a horticultural expert, and he's also the president of the National Agricultural Research Alliance. And we're going to be talking about the interesting and very odd origin of how some of the plants that we use have become part of our holiday landscape, how to select these plants, and also how to care for these plants that at some time, in some cases can be very, very expensive. Also, we're going to discuss how to pick and care for an actual live cut Christmas tree and how to properly care for it throughout the Christmas season. So at this point, I'd like to welcome John Peter Thompson to the show. Good afternoon, John Peter.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be back, and it's the holiday season, and there's nothing better than having beautiful flowers light up the darkness of winter. I mean, that's what flowers do. They bring light to us, and they've become related to and expected to in the season. And certain flowers now are considered part of the winter or holiday season. And you mentioned a couple of them, and I'm sure we're going to talk about that. You also mentioned that I'm president of the National Agricultural Research Alliance. And that's right. As a volunteer organization, we advocate for the people in programs in long-term agricultural research at the federal level. In other words, we are a group of people that believe that agriculture is important and that we need to continue keeping the science behind agriculture up to date and ongoing. And let me add that agriculture is a broad term and includes horticulture, and one of the things we advocate for is the National Arboretum, which is part of the United States Department of Agriculture, and it is the home of it's the home of new ornamental plants for the landscape. Now, by new, it's everything from ornamental edible peppers, which maybe we'll have another radio show and talk about. They introduced one that has little pumpkin-shaped peppers on black leaves. This is the home of the crape myrtle. It's the home of the Glendale azalea, 450 varieties. This is agricultural research in horticulture that extends right into your garden, the New Guinea impatiens, the varieties that you see. The work was done at USDA, ARS, the National Arboretum. So my interest is not only in food supply and the safety You know, are we going to have wheat next year, or is some disease going to take it out? But I'm interested in the work of the scientists and researchers to continue to develop new plants for the ornamental garden.
Let me just ask you, how many of the plants that we see on display for the holiday season, how many of them have been genetically modified, or is it that they're just cultivars?
Well, they're cultivars. There are no GMOs, as you are referring to it. Nobody is inserting genes right now and then crossing the plants with fish to give us new seasonal or landscape plants. But they are cultivars. They are hybridized. That means that using scientific methods and statistical tools, scientists and hybridizers have worked steadily to shorten plants. For instance, the poinsettia, the red plant that you mentioned, and we'll talk about the Secretary of War piece in a minute. This plant is actually a hedge or a tree, and it is hybridization. That is, taking the pollen from one plant and putting it on the flower of another plant and getting seeds and trying to get a specific characteristic. The hybridization has resulted in the multitude of colors. We have whites to yellows to pinks to marbled, sort of a lavender purplish, kind of a hard color to describe, to brilliant reds, speckled patterns, variegated patterns. All of this is from traditional hybridization, taking the pollen of one plant, putting it on the other plant, harvesting the seed and seeing what comes back up, and then taking the best traits from these offspring and continuing the work over years. So the poinsettia is a plant native to Mexico, to Central America, to more tropical climates than snow-covered New York, where it won't survive outside. And it was part of the U.S. government's edict to its ministers abroad in the time of Andrew Jackson and John Quincy Adams. That's the 1820s and 1830s. Foreign ministers of the U.S. government were instructed to report back on and send back valuable new species that might aid business in America. In other words, the government of the U.S. was looking for plants all over the world that could grow here in the United States and become part of the business of the United States, whether it was to produce food or an ornamental value or textile or feed. The what we would call it embassies today, the ambassadors and ministers to countries such as Mexico and Joel Poinsett was minister to Mexico, and as part of his duties, he reported back on plants. Now, the Secretary of War, well, he becomes Secretary of War under Martin Van Buren, the old New Yorker president, and hence the correlation with the Secretary of War and the poinsettia. I don't know that we actually call it the Secretary of War plant, but the poinsettia of Christmas, the beautiful red, white, pink plant that you see in the stores and in nurseries and in garden centers, was brought to the attention of the United States and introduced to the people of the United States by a man who became Secretary of War, Joel.
So that's really interesting, but if you think about it, if they were to call the poinsettia the Secretary of War, it doesn't have the same appeal. I mean, Christmas is a time of peace and rebirth. The Secretary of War kind of it's a big buzzkill.
Sure. Well, that's why it's not known as the Secretary of War. Its history is related to the Secretary of War, to the man, the American, who went to Mexico and saw possibilities of this plant and introduced it to the United States. But it doesn't really become a big part of Christmas until after World War II. And nursery families like Paul Ecke out in California really took the lead at first hybridizing manageable plants, dwarfing them, if you will, and getting plants to bloom on schedule, on time, in the holiday season. These are the leaders in the 1940s and 1950s who really market the plant that they have hybridized into the American home for Christmas. So while it was introduced in the 1840s, it's really 100 years later that it becomes part of the American tradition, the points, the ubiquitous poinsettia that you see all over the place. And you mentioned the Hanukkah plant. When I was in the nursery business, we decided, having read a floral trade industry magazine, to try our hand at taking a white poinsettia. And remember, when you're looking at a poinsettia, those red, pink, and white flowers, those aren't actually the flowers, those are leaves. The flowers are insignificant in the center of all of this. So we took a white poinsettia and we sprayed a floral spray paint on alternating leaves of the white flower, and we sprayed it a light blue and added a little glitter, and we sold it as a Hanukkah plant. And it sold, much to my amazement. People that weren't celebrating Christmas but were celebrating the time of year and the season said, hey, we have a use for this kind of plant too that reflects our traditions and the colors of Israel. So we had the Hanukkah plant as a sort of floral artistic tribute to a different tradition of the same season. So the poinsettia is ubiquitous. It's all over the place today. 50 years of hybridization and work by the nursery industry has placed it in the midst of our Christmas season. And a poinsettia is not, well, it's an easy plant to grow. But it's not easy to get it to bloom when you want exactly at Christmas. That has to do with timing in September around the autumnal equinox and making sure that each day gets shorter by an equal number of minutes over a period of time. We're not going to go into the formula. You can look it up online. But it becomes a problem if you try to do this at home. You have to make sure lights don't go on and people don't accidentally leave the window open, and you've got to have this slowly declining amount of daylight in order to trigger the color set, or what we call the bloom.
Well, don't you have to leave it in the, well, I mean, I remember my mother had one, and she used to leave it in the closet so
that
it had complete darkness.
That's so that you all could turn the lights on in the house. That's why she left it in the closet. She was trying to get it dark at the right time. When the sun went down, it had to be dark. And any amount of light beyond moonlight would stop it from blooming at Christmas. So she simply put it in the closet. Hopefully during the daytime she didn't have it in the closet because it also needs daylight.
Now, John, can you just explain from a horticultural perspective why the poinsettia is so unique in the sense that it, you need to really manipulate the light in order for it to produce the red color? Why? What does this manipulation of light actually do, and why does it differ from other plants that actually want sunlight?
Well, first of all, it doesn't differ. Many, many of our garden plants and also our plants in the farm require the chemicals they need to produce flowers and therefore seed are triggered by a ratio of daylight to no light, and the change in that amount of time. So chrysanthemums and asters, for example, also need a certain regime of light in order to bloom. In other words, the amount of light is a major way a plant figures out what the right time it is for it to bloom. What it does is it records chemically how much daylight there is, and then watches the pattern, either the increase or decrease in the daylight. That triggers a chemical process that tells the plant, go ahead and bloom and set seed. So some plants need increasing daylight, and some plants need decreasing. So the poinsettia is in the family of decreasing daylight. It knows that it should set bloom so that it can set seed, so there can be new poinsettia plants, Euphorbia pulchrissima is its name. It knows this by the change in daylight pattern. When you disrupt that pattern, you can manipulate when the plant will actually bloom, and that's true. That's how you get forced mums and forced azaleas. The florist industry has been well aware of these patterns necessary to get different plants to bloom at different times or off season, and has known about it for well over 150 years, since the middle of the 19th century.
What other plants are very common that we see, whether it's in a nursery or just common plants that people have that are similar, in which the manipulation of light is really critical to the beauty that people desire?
Well, so the aster family, the entire chrysanthemum family, is more or less based on this light decreasing pattern. They set their flowers based on this light pattern. And I have to also add, there's a temperature trigger in all of this too. That's
I was
going to
say, don't asters bloom in the fall?
Yes, but how do they know it's fall? They can't go to a calendar.
Here in the Northeast, the temperature always decreases after October.
Yeah, but more importantly, they have to know that before the temperature decreases in order to start the flower, and it's the change in day length, along with temperature changes, but it's the change in light that triggers the chemicals to stop growing and set buds.
Now, okay, we have the red poinsettias, and then you have the white ones, which, I can't say I'm a big fan of the white ones, even though I've seen some beautiful, beautiful displays, but, you know, the red ones, they always remind me of my parents. Now, are they trying to create any other colors?
Well, they're always trying to create other colors, and the white originally was kind of not much, but in the last 20 years, again, the hybridizers, mostly in the private industry, like Paul Ecke, have come up with really brilliant white and then a marbled color, sort of red and white splotches. All of this from hybridization. And so the answer is yes, they are trying to come up with other colors. So now they have what I call Thanksgiving poinsettias, yellows and golds, so that you could create a Thanksgiving display with a cornucopia of fruits and pumpkins, you know, falling out, and have a small yellow poinsettia that blends right in with the golds and autumn colors. So that,
and that's also a cultivar?
Oh, yeah. I've been out of the business so long, and I've forgotten the name, but, oh, yeah, it's cultivar, and if you go online, you'll find the yellow and gold-colored poinsettias, usually sold still. It's kind of a new idea to have a poinsettia blooming at Thanksgiving that matches your Thanksgiving display, so the industry is still trying to market it, but they're readily available.
What's interesting about that is the fact that typically in horticulture, when you see a plant that has yellow or brown leaves, that's usually a sign that the plant is about to expire.
Yeah, no.
Typically, not always. I mean,
yellow. Well, that's not true, because if you think of the sunflower, it's not getting ready to expire. And the
well, the sunflower is, but I'm just saying
yellow.
Leaves, because with the poinsettia, it's basically,
But remember, these leaves are part of the flower complex that includes sepal. I mean, the flowers are complicated, and they have supporting structure, and the leaves that turn colors are a supporting structure. It's classic of this genus, this group of euphorbia, where the sepals, or the supporting structure of the flowers, are used to attract pollinators. Nature has developed them, where in the sunflower it's actually the flower itself that attracts the pollinator. So don't think of this as all the leaves turn yellow. These are specific structures of the plant.
I'm saying it's unique in the sense that for most people, when they see a yellow leaf, they think that the plant is dying or about to expire. I've seen other examples. I went on a tour with the local chapter of the American Rhododendron Society here in New York, and I remember going on a tour of one property in which the property owner was stating that I can't remember what he was talking about specifically, but he pointed that out because most people didn't realize that it was supposed to have that color for this time of the year.
One of the things that my grandfather taught me, and he learned the trade from his father. So we go back to the 1880s. From 1880 into the 1950s, variegated plants were usually seen as a sign of disease or stress or poor quality. It was very hard to market a variegated plant up until about the 1960s. Collectors and plant specialists understood the value, but the public thought that if it wasn't a deep green, then there was something wrong. It must be chlorotic. And so, yes, I can see where somebody would say yellow in a leaf is a problem, but today, if you know the plant, then an Akuba with its yellow spots, this is a desirable thing. Of course, a rhododendron with yellow leaves is a rhododendron that's dying. We don't have yellow variegated rhododendrons that I'm aware of. So, depending on the plant, yellow can be a sign of chlorosis, of problem, of nitrogen deficiency. But in the terms of the poinsettia, these leaves are right around the flower, and from a gardener public point of view, we call them the flower. So it's a deep green leaf with a beautiful yellow or gold flower. And if the lower leaves, the deep green ones, were yellow, then you wouldn't be buying it because, yeah, that would be one that was either overwatered or underwater and dying. There are other colors. As I mentioned, there's a whole palette of, my wife tells me I'm bad with colors, mauve, sort of muddy purples, and now, geez, that's horrible. They're lavender, but not on the blue side, on the pink side. They're sort of deeper shades of pink. And all of these are poinsettia colors. And then, of course, there are the pinks, from soft pinks to hot pinks. And they're all hybrids. They're all cultivars that have been, through traditional hybridization and repeated cross-pollination and selecting, you know, a red plant that is slightly less red and more pink and then crossing onto it until you get the pink and then the white and then these other colors. Yes, indeed. Now, I guess the holy grail would be a blue one. That's not happening. That would require your old friend genetic modification, I think. Maybe a caller can call in and tell me I'm wrong, but my guess is now you'd be talking about modern gene splicing in order to get blue supporting leaves, structural flowers for a poinsettia.
Would people even want it?
Well,
then again,
the Romans had that saying, non est disputandum gustibus, there's no arguing with taste. We like to be the first to have something unusual. So that sort of takes care of the poinsettia. The poinsettia, by the way, when you buy it from a nursery and you bring it home, make sure that it's wrapped tightly. It's not going to like 30-degree wind blowing around it. That's sure way to lose its bottom leaves. You don't want it to dry out, and you don't want it to sit in water. You want to water it when it needs watering. That basically could be every day if your house is very hot and every few days if your house is cool. The poinsettia will last well into January, maybe even February, if your daytime temperatures are below 70. If you keep the poinsettia in a room in the mid to upper 60s and night temperature, 62 to 65, it wouldn't go colder than that. It doesn't like that. But in the 60s and certainly below 72, your poinsettia is going to have flowers and leaves and be very happy right through January. And if you sort of baby it along, even when it's not looking right, you can put it out after danger of frost in a morning sun, afternoon shade place, kind of bury it, pot and all, right out in the garden.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed about my poinsettia is that the leaves shrink, or it just seems that way. They go from these big, full leaves down to these little,
Well, it's a tropical
things.
Plant that doesn't like our humidity-free houses. We do a lot in our modern North American houses to take the humidity out, and the poinsettia struggles against our low humidity environs, and the leaves begin to shrink. And eventually, the plant wants to go into a sort of regenerative approach. It's going to drop all its leaves. You cut cut everything off and let it sprout off again in the spring if you were going to try to keep it over. That's a lot of work. And, we probably should talk about mistletoes and Christmas trees before we get lost in the specifications of attempting to try to keep a poinsettia through the summer.
Well, one of the things I also notice is that I always get a lot of these little white bugs on the poinsettias.
Yes, you can get all kinds of everything from the fungus gnat, a little sort of brownish, light-colored, insignificant cloud of flying things that sort of comes out of the soil, to mealybugs, which are little white stem feeders. If you get them, I mean, there's one of two ways. One, you got it from a nursery that wasn't paying attention, or two, you've got them on the underleaves of some of your houseplants and they've just sort of hop over. Poinsettias are well known for their fickleness. They cause a lot of problems for nursery growers because every disease and bug in the book hits them. From whitefly, and whitefly is a big one on poinsettias, a cloud of little white insects. I remember maybe 20
years ago. I think that's what I get, yeah.
20 years ago, we sent some, our nursery used to sell to the White House, and we sent poinsettias down and got a call, oh my God, we found a whitefly, you have to come down here and get rid of it. Have to go searching through the plants to find the white fly to make them happy down there.
Must have been fun.
So they get that, and then they get fungal diseases in the greenhouse. That poinsettia that you're either have or thinking about having, somebody started growing it on, as they call it, in June. They ordered from if they didn't take the cuttings themselves, from stock plants, which is what we used to have, they will air freight in cuttings in June, late June, and they will stick the cuttings in pots with mist systems on timers, and they will do this at 3 o'clock in the morning so that the heat of the summer doesn't fry the unrooted cutting, and they will grow these things from July until they ship them out around Thanksgiving. Once they've set flower. So this is a six-month project for a nursery. They don't just grow them and send them to you. They invest 6 months of tender, loving care and knowledge into producing these plants.
It's a lot of work just to go into one plant, and I guess the big question is it worth it keeping it?
Sure, because here's why. The nursery business in North America, without the poinsettia, would close up on Columbus Day. What else would they sell? There'd be no cash income. The poinsettia is a major cash crop that allows nurseries to try to stay open year-round.
Interesting.
That's why they grow it, to give them something to sell after the growing season is shut down in October.
Now, next to the poinsettia, you mentioned mistletoe. Now, aren't both toxic to animals?
Yeah, you know, something, there are many kinds of mistletoes. So the European mistletoe is toxic. Interestingly enough, I don't actually know if the American version is toxic, but, gee, I wouldn't go trying. I'd assume that all of these semi-parasitic plants are toxic to somebody at some level.
Now, you said that these are semi-parasitic plants. Can you please define that for our listeners that are not too sure what that exactly means?
Well, in the case of mistletoe, think of it as it gets most of its nutrients from the host tree or shrub, usually a tree here in North America. It is able to get some nutrients and water on its own. So it has green leaves. It's able to take sunlight and sort of feed itself. But it's dependent on its host root system and the plant capillary system, the transportation of nutrients from the roots. That's why it's semi-parasitic. There are plants like Japanese dodder that looks all the world like a ball of yarn that's been strung out over a plant in yellows and blues. It's completely parasitic. It has no ability to manufacture sugars. It has no chlorophyll in it. And so it's completely parasitic. Witchweed, which is destroying agricultural crops in Africa, is parasitic, but mistletoe is green, so it's semi-parasitic. It's able to feed itself, but it has to have a host to get additional nutrients and things necessary to survive. Now, mistletoe, I've never seen this, so I'm just going to throw it out there. Reportedly, how do you harvest mistletoe if you're in a hurry? Because it's up there in the trees, you know, 30, 40, 50 feet up. You know, go out with your shotgun and shoot it down.
Okay, well, that might be a little extreme,
though.
But that's, I have to admit, that's probably the wackiest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, well, the other choice is getting a ladder out in the middle of nowhere and climbing up 30 to 40 feet to get the mistletoe, because you aren't going to grow it in a greenhouse.
Well,
so you have to get it somehow.
Well, it's
so hunting mistletoe, big.
It gives new meaning to hunting mistletoe, but I think that's people might wonder, okay, is that person a little, you know, off their rock off to do something like that?
See, that's the person that goes hunting and doesn't offend PETA. Because it's not hunting animals, it's just hunting mistletoe.
I think they might wind up hurting themselves. But now, another favorite is holly. How did holly become such a big favorite for the holidays?
Well, hollies are part of the larger family of evergreens, and this gets us to the sort of the collision of two cultures, the Roman culture and Saturnalia, which was the festival that was celebrated around the solstice, and simply put, was a festival celebrating the return of daylight. The Romans knew that on the shortest day of the year, then the days proceeded to get longer, and they had a celebration. And part of the celebration was the recognition that certain plants, including the holly and one very important plant that I should remember, olives, were evergreen. And you can quickly see the idea of evergreen, eternal life, and the idea of you can get through this darkness, that life continues, and the evergreen certainly brought to the Romans this sense of eternity and eternal life. Now, the tradition that collides with this is the Norse Nordic Teutonic tradition. And again, they have the same idea. The evergreen symbolized a sort of eternity. You know, it didn't go through these stages, at least from their point of view, of growth, life, death. It didn't have the seasons of spring, summer, fall, and winter, the season of death. It was sort of permanent and always there. And one of the things that some of the Teutonic tribes, the Romans described, would cut an evergreen, could be a holly, usually was a spruce or some kind of pine, and put it over their abode, both to keep, I don't want to call it spirits, but to protect the abode. And it's this idea of eternity that holly has and that other evergreens such as spruces and pines have, that are reflected in our placing these ropes and swags and wreaths. We're showing that even in the darkest day, the light is coming, that life is eternal, and there's hope.
Now, when you're cutting holly, holly is very pointy, and it does hurt, especially if you're trying to incorporate twigs of holly. That's the correct way to describe it, correct? I guess branches. Well, it's not necessarily...
American and Chinese holly is very... Well, actually, English holly, too, have little pointy deals on the leaves, and...
Yeah, they're pretty painful,
especially
if you're trying to incorporate it into your wreath. I know at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, usually around the holiday, in December, we usually, the master composters usually get together and we have an event in which we get together and we make wreath, you know, the Christmas wreaths together, and it's really, really nice, but... the thing is that the first time that I did it, I couldn't believe how scratched up my hands got. And
so here's the solution. You can cheat and use Japanese hollies that don't have thorns. Or you can keep in mind Lincoln's, let's see if I get this right. You know, some people complain that a rose is a flower on a thorn bush. Well, I'm probably messing this up, but he was intrigued that it's a thorn bush that has a beautiful flower. We learn to use...
That's interesting. That's a really great way to point that.
I'll have to go look up my own... having mangled that little quote, I'll look it up and send it to you. In the florist shop and people whose hands hadn't been scarred by working with roses, you put on leather gloves. There are gardener
gloves. Yeah,
that's
definitely the smart thing to do. But the first time that you're making a wreath, you know.
Now, my grandfather would never have let that happen. He said, you can't use gloves in the garden. How can you feel what you're doing? But he also said, when he reached into a rose bush to cut flowers and the thorn scratched him, he said, oh, the women liked the blood, as he handed the women the bouquet of roses. So, you know.
Fascinating. So let me ask you, if you are going to, say if you want to just go to the forest and get some holly so that you can make your own wreath, what should you look for?
Well, you should look for red berries, first of all, otherwise you miss the fun of the holly. I mean, just having the green without the red berries seems that provides background, but you could cut just about anything evergreen to get the berries. So you're looking for an American holly with red berries.
Yeah, but don't the berries drop off at some point?
Yes, but usually not at Christmas unless your birds are really hungry. They usually drop off January, February, March, the ones that are left that the birds didn't get.
Because I found that I prefer the variegated holly, which is a green with the white. It's like an off-white outline.
Yeah, probably an English holly.
It's very pretty. It's so pointy, but it's very pretty. And I just found that, especially with the berries, my concern is that if the berries fall off, I don't want any of the neighbors' cats or dogs to eat them.
I'll have to say, you got me there. Haven't thought about that. I know our cats and dogs never seem to have a problem, but that doesn't mean there wouldn't be one. So
yeah, exactly. It's the one creature that you're concerned about that you didn't think about, you know. But that's one thing that I think is, you know, holly is just such a beautiful. It's such a beautiful thing to add to any wreath or even table arrangement. And now, how often, if you do make a wreath out of raw materials that you get from either your own backyard or if you go to the forest and, ask, you know, for cuttings, how do you know what is fresh and what to look for? And how much should you be paying realistically?
Uh-oh. I don't know if I can anymore. I've been out of the business too long to tell you realistic prices, so I'm going to have to defer on that question. But obviously, if you cut it yourself, you know it's fresh. Let me tell you that the wreaths that come out of the Midwest and out of Canada, they start cutting them in August, just like the cut trees.
Really?
Yeah. Now,
how do they keep them so fresh? Do they freeze them?
Remember, they have to, well, sure, they refrigerate them.
Wow.
They have to, I mean, they're supplying millions of these things. You don't think that they're like Santa Claus and they do it the day after Thanksgiving. I mean, they not only have to cut them, sort them, and prepare it, they have to ship it. So they're starting to cut around Labor Day and carefully get these trees dispersed across North America, right down into the deserts of Arizona. So that requires a 90-day window. So they got to start harvesting fairly easy.
But so then, say if you do have a finished wreath, how often should you water it, and how do you water it? Do you just take a spray bottle? What do you recommend?
Yes, well, so a finished wreath, we had wreaths that we'd get in right about Thanksgiving, and we would hose them down twice a day, early in the morning and then sometime around lunchtime. Now, if it was freezing out, didn't need to do that. Freezing is good for a wreath, for evergreens, hollies and evergreens.
Yeah, but you don't have to water them still?
Well, if you water when it's freezing, what you get is ice burn at best and a block of ice at worst. So if it's below 32, you can wait till it warms up a little bit. You're not getting the evaporation below 32. But above 32, you start to have problems. And one of the big mistakes is hanging a swag or a wreath on your front door between the front door and the storm door. That's a recipe for cooking. No matter how much you water your wreath, it isn't going to last. You have to hang it on the outside. You have to let the cold air get to it, and you sure don't want to create your own little mini hothouse by hanging the wreath behind the glass of the storm door. So if it's 70 degrees out, you need to be watering your wreath, you know, in the morning and sometime at midday, or it's going to desiccate. It's that fancy word for dry out.
Now, one of the odd things that I've seen up here in the Northeast is people that will actually take a Christmas wreath and wire it to the front of their vehicle, whether it's a truck or a car. How smart of an idea is that? Because you would think that with the heat from the engine, it would cook it as it, you're going through, you know, the winter elements.
The problem is not the heat from the engine. My guess is the problem is if you have a week of 70-plus degree days, which we certainly can get with our strange weather, that the ambient temperature is going to cook it. On the other hand, if you're down in the 30s in the daytime and the 20s at night, it's going to be fine. Your engine isn't going to heat up to do enough to it. I mean, unless you're, well, it isn't going to hang. We have this down in Washington. They last a few weeks down here, and mostly it's road salt that does the wreath in, not the heat, unless we get one of our post-Indian summer 70-degree December weeks.
Now, I just want to touch upon the subject that we just spoke about, the cost of buying these greens. For the most part, you're actually buying scraps. So what I would recommend to people, I used to actually teach classes to teach people how to make a wreath. The first time that you make a wreath, it's an experience you will never forget because it's so much work. But once you get the hang of it, it's all about layers. And, you know, some people like consistency. They will use pine as opposed to spruce, you know, the branches, but there is a rhythm to the madness. But for the most part, the cuttings that you should be looking for, you should really try to go to either a lot where they sell Christmas trees or, you know, check out your local florist to see what they can do for you, because for the most part, these are scraps. So you should be able to get something realistically that is still very good, but relatively inexpensive. Now, John, say if you want to go into your backyard or wherever you want to go to cut them yourself, what do you recommend that people do who are not experts that don't necessarily want to damage the tree as they're cutting the branches, but how far down should they be cutting the branches, and what advice would you give them? How many nodes down should they be cutting?
The easiest, well, it's a little difficult on an evergreen to count nodes, but what you don't want to do is cut the branch all the way back to a point where there's no green leaves. So I used to tell people, cut no more than a third of whatever branch you've eyeballed, and then you'll know that you've left enough to regenerate. Because if you go past where the green leaves are, there's a good chance that that branch will never, it won't have any new leaves. I mean, it depends on the plant. But
yeah, it's just going to be kind of a hole in the plant. Yeah, I mean, you can see evidence. Yeah, go ahead.
Just about a third. You identify a branch, looks pretty good. Don't go more than a third, and certainly not more than halfway back on the green leaf-bearing part of the branch. Don't measure the halfway from the trunk to the tip, but identify where the leaves start and only cut a third of it.
Now,
then you're pruning.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just like
cutting
your hedge.
This way it's not doing any damage, because some people, they just think, oh, you know, I'll just cut any old branch. I remember I had a friend who thought she knew everything, and she was about to take her shears and go to town on one of my trees, and I looked at her and I said, "Whoa, what are you doing?" And I trimmed the branch for her, and I said, "You don't do that because you're basically going to destroy the beauty of that tree." And when in doubt, contact your local cooperative extension if you live in the United States. If you live outside the United States, what resources can people refer to if they live outside the United States, John?
Well, most European countries and Canada have their own version of cooperative extension. So you'll find a ministry that is there to support your botanical conquest one way or the other. Now, if you move past the EU, Japan, and North America, that's a little beyond my ken at the moment. I don't know who you
call.
When
in doubt, go on the internet and I guess check out some of the cooperative extensions here in the United States, especially Cornell Cooperative Extension. They have a lot of great information there. Now, John, getting to Christmas tree selection. Most people, they see a Christmas tree, they're really not too sure what to get because one tree looks just like the other because they're wrapped up, and it's really difficult to tell what the tree looks like. So what advice would you give to someone that is looking to buy a fresh tree, and how would you recommend that they care for that tree so that they don't wind up with the needles dropping, you know, 2 days after they buy it?
Yes, well, the first thing is if you can post yourself next to the delivery entry ramp, you want to buy the tree when the tree comes in. I mean, that's the best thing. So that means you really don't want to buy a tree 1st of November. You really want the tree to be delivered somewhere right around the week of Thanksgiving, and that's the tree that you want to try to get a hold of. The next thing is I would never buy a tree that came wrapped. I want to see the tree unwrapped and then have the store or tree lot wrap it for me, and that shouldn't be a problem. I mean, that if it is, you've got to be asking yourself, is the discount you're paying for not seeing the tree worth it? So you want to see the tree.
Well, that's not always possible. I mean, I was in New York City for the tree lighting, which was just yesterday, and I was in the city by Rockefeller Plaza, and I noticed that there was this one particular tree lot, and all the trees were wrapped, and it's basically due to spacing constraints.
Does the Latin phrase caveat emptor mean anything to you? Let the buyer beware.
Well, so you should ask the merchant to please open it up.
Sure, because the next test you want to do is to lightly wiggle some of the branches and see how many of the needles fall off, and how are you going to do that if it's wrapped up? Now, every cut tree is going to drop some needles. So this is a little bit of intuition. If you do the old Snoopy peanuts deal and you kind of lightly tap the tree and then you're left with branches with no needles, that is not the tree you want to buy.
No.
If you lightly tap a branch and a few needles fall off but you can't tell the difference, that's a pretty good tree. That's a pretty good tree. So you have to make an intuitive guess at the percentage of needles that are falling off the tree when you lightly bounce your hands, especially against mid and lower branches, because the tree is going to die from the cut up, not from the top down. So what about the height?
Because, I mean, the height can be very, very misleading because, I mean, some people think, oh, the bigger the better, and then you bring the tree to your house and you can't fit the thing through the door.
Well, yes, that's a non-horticultural problem. That's more an interior decorating problem. Eyes are bigger than the stomach is beyond my ken. You need to know how tall your ceiling is, and you need to know how many inches your stand is going to add to the cut tree before you go out and buy, and you need to have your tape measure with you to make sure that you don't have to cut extra pieces off the bottom of the tree. Now, many nurseries will cut, if you find a tree you want and it's just a little tall, they'll on-the-spot cut off a few inches or whatever you identify at the bottom of the tree, that they'll do that as a service. I mean, most nurseries that I know of.
So also when you do get the tree back home, you should have a pair of pruning shears because I don't know of anybody that's ever brought a tree home and not had to do some pruning, just some minor pruning just to make it fit into, you know, whether it's a corner of the room or wherever you're going to place the tree. So that's something that's,
You also have to know what kind of tree stand you have. We used a center pin stand, which meant we drilled a hole in the center of the trunk that fit over a pin in the center of the stand to make sure the tree was absolutely perpendicular to the floor. Not everybody does that. Many people just do a cross cut and you put it into a stand. You have 3 to 5 screws and you kind of screw them in and hope that you get all the screws at the same tension so that the tree is standing upright. So know what kind of stand you have, and better yet, bring it with you to make sure that your trunk is going to fit into your stand, because not some trunks can have a wider diameter than your stand, and that's a problem once you get home, too. You want all the problems addressed at the lot, where they have the equipment to do it, to take care of things. Mm. Now, the big secret is when you bring the tree home, you really should put it in a sort of tepid water bath, not hot water. Do not put it in hot water. Cold water would be better, but cold water kind of seals things up. So tepid water, and allow the tree to soak up water better overnight. I mean, a few hours at least. But better overnight. Because the trick here is to make sure that the bottom of the tree where it's cut stays in water. And you're going to find, if you do this right, that you're going to be adding water to the base, to the stand, which you should have a stand that can hold water. You should be adding water daily. And this will keep your tree going for 4 or 5 weeks, assuming you don't have the temperature at 80 degrees. The cooler the temperature, the longer the tree will hold its needles.
Is there anything that you should add to the water?
You know, there are all kinds of sugar recipes and special formulations that you can buy. I've tried a lot of things, and I've never found much of a difference from just making sure that I got the tree into water, gave it time to get the water cycling up, and then didn't let the tree run out of water when it was in the stand. So you can go online, and there are all kinds of recipes, and I don't think any of them hurt anything. And maybe some of your listeners will try some of these and report back to you successes. I just found that the tepid water by itself worked fine, and the trees would last. The big secret is not at 80 degrees.
No, definitely not.
No tree is going to last at 80 degrees. If you have a room in the where you can watch the tree and keep it in the 60s and turn the temperature up when you're home for a few hours, that's fine. The tree doesn't, you want 80 degrees for a few hours, then turn the temperature down in that room and let it go back into as cold as you dare make the room, and the tree will last and last and last.
Mm.
Also, direct sunlight on the tree through a window. If you put the tree next to a window, of course, you're going to cook the tree. It's the old greenhouse effect. It's how we nurserymen get plants to grow in the winter in the first place. We put the piece of glass between the plant in winter, and the sun cooks it. So try to keep the tree away from direct sunlight day after day. These are tricks to keeping the needles on, the tree green, and the fire hazard down. And don't forget that if your tree starts to really drop needles and turn yellow and have yellow and brown needles making a dense mat, you have a potential fire hazard if your circuitry goes wrong or you're near a fireplace. A cut tree that has dried out will go up in an instant. There's no fire extinguisher that's going to pull it out. So I don't want to scare anybody, but don't let your tree dry out.
Now, what about the sap? Can you do anything to prevent the sap from running?
Well, no, sap runs. We used to put sort of old cloth on the floor or on the carpet back in grandmother's house to sort of a white sheet or a colored sheet, old sheet. Then she sort of decorated the tops of them so the sap didn't ruin the carpet. There's nothing that I know that really can do that. There are fire retardants, by the way, I didn't finish, though I think they're getting harder and harder to find, that you can get some nurseries to spray on trees. But they retard the fire, they don't stop the fire. And certainly the best way is to make sure that the tree is taking water up daily. If it's doing that, you reduce sort of your worries. Now, here's the last thing with the tree. After Christmas and the branch, and you've done everything right, so you've kept it cool, you've kept it water, you now take the decorations off, and you have this tree with these green boughs. You cut the branches off, and you put them over the pansies that you planted in September and October in your garden, and you put one branch, you don't layer them, but one branch along wherever you have pansies, and the pansies will begin to bloom underneath the branch of the Christmas, of the cut Christmas tree, because it will provide protection from winter winds. Pansies don't mind the cold, but the flowers get damaged by the wind, so you make a little microclimate with the branches of your cut Christmas tree. And when the needles fall off, which they will do sometime in March, you remove the branches in your branch compost pile, and the pansies will be happily blooming for another 90 days till Mother's Day.
Interesting. Now, one thing I do want to mention with cut Christmas trees is that most people think that, you know, they want to put the tree out so that it can be composted. And one of the biggest problems that one of the biggest reasons why Christmas trees wind up in the landfill is because people don't think. They think that, oh, well, you know what, I'm going to just take the tree as it is and put it in a bag and put it on the curb. If you want to properly dispose of your Christmas tree, remove all of the ornaments, including any tinsel, any hooks, anything. Make sure that it's completely just as it was when you first purchased it. Because the reason being is that when the Department of Sanitation picks it up, they have to physically have someone manually remove these things, and unfortunately, there's not enough labor to do that. And so the tree will wind up, instead of being composted, it'll wind up going right to the landfill. And I mean, it's bizarre. Every single year we see people that will put it in these fancy bags to, just take the whole tree and put it on the curb. And we just, you know, it's just baffling. But folks, once again, make sure that you remove all of the ornaments, all of the hooks, all of the tinsel, everything. Leave it bare bones right on the curb. This way the tree can be composted properly. And, the tree can actually go to some use. So I just wanted to point that out. John, any last-minute advice on tree selection and care?
Pick the tree that looks most like Christmas to you. There are firs, there are spruces, there are pines, and there's the ubiquitous balsam fir is probably the standard by which others judge trees, and it lasts a long time. It's got everything going for it. Balsam fir is a good choice. I like blue spruce, but they're really expensive. Retail price on a 6-foot blue spruce when I was doing this was probably reaching $75 plus, so I can't imagine what it is now, whereas comparable balsam is 1/3 that cost. That's sort of it for Christmas trees, unless you do the live Christmas tree. Remember, we've been talking about basically dead Christmas trees.
Yes, the live Christmas trees. Can you really quickly talk about that, because we're
sure.
Almost out of time?
It used to be that you bought a house that you were going to stay until you were a grandparent, and one of the things, the joys of Christmas, was buying a live, say, Norway spruce, bringing it in for a week, decorating it for between Christmas and New Year's, and then quickly putting it outside, and when your grandchildren are around, you could point out that 60-foot tree was their mother's or father's first Christmas tree, and you'd line your drive, your 5-acre driveway with these memory trees, is what we called them. They're great, especially the Norway spruce. The problem is you can't keep a live tree inside for 6 weeks, 5 weeks, or 4 weeks, really 7 to 10 days. And
no, and I actually had I won in a holiday raffle this dwarf. I don't even know the type of tree it was, but it was a dwarf, and it was really beautiful. I did not have the time to plant it outside, and unfortunately, it just started turning brown. And
yeah, you have to have a plan to do this right, which includes saying we're going to do it and digging the hole in October when you can still dig. Now, this year, winter hasn't come down here, so you could still dig it now, but you don't want the ground to freeze and you can't dig the hole, and then you want to be able to put the tree out and plant it as soon as the ground unfreezes. So, I mean, it's a great idea. You need a lot of space. You know, a Norway spruce or a blue spruce can get 30, 40, 50, 60 foot tall, so you're not doing this on an eighth of an acre or at a townhouse. You need land, and that's one of the reasons the tradition is dying. We don't have these large lots anymore. We, a lot of people, little land, little lots. So there are small trees like dwarf Alberta spruce that only get 5-6 foot tall, and you could use one of those as a living Christmas tree and plant it on a small townhouse lot.
Now, another thing that I want to point out is something that I've seen quite a bit for the last several years is, and I've seen this not only in grocery stores but in nurseries, where they'll take something like rosemary and they will, they'll somehow guide the branches to form
sure.
the shape of a Christmas tree. Now, one of the things that I just want to point out is that if you were going to buy one of these trees, check to see how moist the soil is, number one. Number two, if the weather has been really, really cold, chances are the thing is going to basically die as soon as you get it home, because rosemary is extremely sensitive. And the minute that you bring it outside, it's going to go into shock, and that's going to be basically the end of your $30, $40 gift or present to yourself, if that may be. Do you have any advice for people that are looking for some type of an herbal tree?
Sure. If you do a topiary rosemary Christmas tree, one would hope that you have a cold porch, enclosed porch, where you can move the topiary out, protect it from the biting winter winds, but keep it cool enough not to expire in the heat of your house until you can plant it out. I have topiary growing, I guess my wife's topiaries are 3 feet high and do fine right through the winter, but they're established. So you're correct. You can't take a rosemary or one of these herbal topiaries from the 70 to 80 degree greenhouse and plant it outside when you're finished with it. You have to have a way of getting it through the rest of the winter into spring. But then you can plant it outside. And if it's, you know, I would assume Long Island would have no problem. I can't speak for upstate New York. That may be too cold for rosemary. But certainly here, Zone 7 in the Mid-Atlantic, rosemary does fine in a sunny place, but not planted in January. It doesn't work that way. So you're right. You have to think through what you're doing, and that's why you should buy your plants from a local garden center where there's somebody who can actually explain to you the pros and cons and the problems that you're facing.
And one other thing that I want to point out, and, you know, John, you're the expert. You tell me if this is a good solution. If you absolutely must have one of these plants, and say if the weather is really cold outside, one of the things that I've done is I've actually wrapped the plant in the supermarket. I'll bring, if I know I'm going to buy it, I'll actually bring something to wrap it with, and I'll cover it so that it's not suffocating, but it's somewhat protected until I get it into the car.
Oh,
and
absolutely. That's, again, the admonition to use a garden center. A garden center will always wrap the plants. If you can't buy it at a garden center, you have to go to a department store or somebody that's not sure what they're selling. You need to take, at the very least, newspaper and you sort of wrap it like you wrap a fish.
Yeah, that's exactly what I've done, and I've had people look
right.
at me like, what are you
oh,
doing?
Oh, no, that's fine.
Yeah.
I remember in the 60s, before we had all the fancy floral wrapping packages for these plants, we saved newspaper all year, and we had the employees and customers bring us our their newspapers. And then throughout Christmas, we wrapped the poinsettias and the violets and everything else in this sort of like a fish in newspaper, and that protected it from the biting wind until you could get home. You can't leave these plants in your car for 5 hours in the winter and go shopping. You need to buy it and go home.
Well, it's kind of like buying ice cream when it's 101 degrees outside, leaving it in your trunk thinking that, oh, yeah, well, you know, it'll survive.
Excellent analogy. Excellent
yeah.
analogy.
You know, it's just ridiculous. Well, I've just seen so many people do that, and it's kind of funny when I'm at the supermarket and I'm looking at these plants. I don't know, for amusement, sometimes I'll just look at the plants just to see how well they're cared for. And you kind of know where you go shopping and the people that work there, how well they're going to care for these plants. You know, some retail shops are better than the other. And a nursery can never go wrong because the nurseries employ people who really not only are knowledgeable about horticulture, but they actually care about the plants and are not going to do something that's detrimental to the livelihood of the plant. But in, you know, for example, some of the hardware stores, you're dealing with clerks that have very, very minimal knowledge, if anything. And more or less, I found that I do more educating on their behalf than anything. But
the wisdom of my grandfather used to ask people, he said, You don't come here to buy hamburger. Why would you go there to buy a flower?
Excellent point. But sometimes if you're out and about, and I remember seeing in a local hardware store, they had the most beautiful mums. I mean, they were just gorgeous. And usually I travel out east to get the mums. But they were just gorgeous. And the price is right. Too good a deal to pass up. And, you know. And
that's what you get. If you know what you're doing, then you can buy anything anywhere. But if you need a little help and assistance, then you need the little small specialty guy who actually has the knowledge. And in our world of trying to drive the price down and get stuff for free, we're driving these people out of business, the people with the knowledge. And what we will be left with are beautiful plants with no explanation of what to do with.
That is very true, but I also want to add that I also have a number of friends that are master gardeners who will actually, just to amuse themselves, they'll buy the plants that are basically on their last leg and see if they can revive them. And it's almost like a challenge to just see if you can resuscitate these plants. And
it's a good thing doctors don't work that way.
For now.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, I have to admit there have been certain plants that I've been able to resuscitate, so to speak, that I was pretty proud of myself, you know, but not everybody has that touch. Now, if I may ask, with the Christmas cacti, what do you recommend as far as selection, and how do people care for the Christmas cacti?
Well, it's another one of these photosensitive plants, by the way. It needs decreasing daylight and increasing nightlight plus a temperature change in order to set buds. It is a cactus, but it's more a succulent rather than a
true cacti, yeah.
A true cacti. So it needs a light, sandy soil, not really rich. I mean, it doesn't want a heavy organic soil. And it needs to be fed in the fall until it blooms, and it needs to have a rest period after it finishes blooming. That means you sort of let up on the feeding and you really let it kind of dry out, not to concrete, but you pull back on the watering, and then you put it under your azaleas for the summer, and you bring it in September.
Now, you mentioned that you put it under the azaleas, John?
Yeah.
Why under the azaleas?
Because then you'll get the right amount of sunlight. You won't burn it up in the sun, and you won't put it under the porch where it gets no light. So azaleas traditionally in the East Coast are east and south-facing, east-facing plants usually don't grow in the north where there's too little light, and they don't grow well in the western sun where there's too much light. So the conditions for your azaleas are exactly right for the conditions during the summer for your Thanksgiving or Christmas cactus.
I will have to remember that. And once again, fabulous advice from the expert. That's why I love having you on the show, John. You are a walking encyclopedia full of horticultural knowledge that is beyond compare of anyone. And I just want to thank you for coming on the show today and for giving such wonderful advice and information as far as and what people should look for, and also the interesting trivia that you provided. It's very interesting when you learn the origin of some of these plants and how they came about. Can you tell people how they can get in touch with you if they have any further questions, or how they can get in touch with you so that you can, if they would like for you to do some work for their organization, or if they have any questions about the invasive species, which you are an expert on?
Sure. Well, my first of all, I'm getting ready to go to California and talk on invasive species in San Diego in, I guess that's on the 12th of December. So as you know, I just came back from Cameroon, and before that, Alaska. In Alaska, I was doing a series of talks, so any of the listeners think they might have a topic and we might be able to get together, they can get me by email, ipetrus@msn.com. That's ipetrus@msn.com. And if that's too much to remember, just Google invasive notes. I'm the first page, and you'll find me, invasive notes. One word or two words, it doesn't matter. Somehow I've managed to occupy the first page of Google. And that will have my email address, and I'd love to come and talk to a group, talk to you. As you can tell, I love to talk.
Well, the information that you have is just... It's just amazing. And every time that you're on, you teach me so much. And so I'm very grateful just to have someone such as yourself who can just talk about so many different areas in horticulture. And it's always an interesting conversation. So, John, thank you so much. And
well, thank you, June. Thank you very much. And someday we're going to do a show on the history of kudzu.
Yes, we definitely have to do that. Folks, thank you again for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer, the host of the Organic View Radio Show. And tomorrow I will have Mr. Christopher Angel. He is the CEO of Angel Bars. And